territories, almost obsessively, recording how many acres per year the islands are losing. So in these very small islands, you can begin to see the anxieties about space. Derek Walcott, for example, ponders the question of whether the destruction of the Caribbean landscapes could signal the loss of the people who inhabit them. And these are new questions when writers are beginning to question the ultimate survivability of Caribbean peoples. So he's thinking of the end of island nations and their peoples in his essay Antilles, Fragments of Epic Memory. And let me quote you this paragraph, which really encapsulates what his concerns are. He writes, "The Caribbean is not a tourist idol, not to its natives. They draw their working strength from it organically, like trees, like the sea almond or the spiced laurel of the heights. Its peasantry and its fishermen are not there to be loved or even photographed. They are trees who sweat and whose bark is filled with salt, which, but every day on some island, rootless trees in suits are signing favorable tax breaks with entrepreneurs, poisoning the sea almond and the spiced laurel of the mountains to their roots. A morning could come in which governments might ask what happened not merely to the forest and the bays, but to a whole people." Now, the concern for the impact of ecological loss in writings about the Caribbean could be found in some of the earliest literary and proto-literary texts written about the region. Afro-Ben, in her novel Orinoco, published in 1688, already pondered what the increasingly intense clearing of the Caribbean forest would mean for the indigenous peoples and animals who had been relegated to the diminishing woods. Ben's sojourn in Suriname in 1653 coincided what has been called the Great Clearing. This is a period between 1650 and 1665 that was marked by devastating deforestation throughout the British and French Caribbean. It resulted in significant soil erosion and in the scarcity and high price of timber for construction and fuel wood, particularly for refining sugar. This is a process that Richard Grove picks up in his book, Green Imperialism, at least as far as St. Vincent is concerned. The geography of Ben's novel, which reflects the history of the development of the plantation economy in British-held territories in the first half of the 17th century, is built on the social and economic separation between the clear land of the sugar plantation to which the narrator belongs as an Englishwoman and the dense woods that are the domain of the indigenous inhabitants. You know, the novel clearly marks these separate geographies, both social and economic. These indigenous forest dwellers, as Ben narrator explains, and I quote, "supply us with what is impossible for us to get, for they do not only in the woods and over the savannas in hunting supply the parts of hounds by swiftly scouring through almost all impassable places and by the mere activity of their feet run down the nimblest deer and other eatable." Ben's text identifies the forest as an endangered liminal terrain, a psychological as well as a physical divide that the indigenous people navigate easily, which represents a fragile barrier to continued colonial expansion. Where the natives will go if the clearing of the forest continues is a question that the novel implies, but it finds impossible to answer. Ben's Creole contemporary, Cuban writer Jose Martin Felix de Agnate y Acosta, celebrates the island's biodiversity while recording one of the earliest acknowledgments of creeping extinctions. In his Llave de Nuevo Mundo, Key to the New World, published in 1666, he offers an implicit Creole-led project for the conservation of Cuba's remarkable biodiversity against the forces of the Spanish Empire, which, as the 18th century opens, seeks to move towards a monocrop system following the successful example of the French and British Caribbean colonies. So here's Cuba at the beginning of the 18th century trying to prepare itself to go forth and cultivate sugar. Cuba's mountains, Arrate writes, and I quote, abound with rich and wild fruit, precious woods, cedar, mahogany, passion fruit trees, guayacos, lignum vita, and other broad and valuable trees. The focus of his study read by crown officials in Spain is to underscore the difference, diversity, and implied self-sufficiency and sustainability of the island as an environmental system, which he keeps underscoring is different from that of Spain. His text is both a description and a boast, as a Creole, a boast of an enviable abundance that is the foundation for a proto-national identification, of an expression of an incipient Cubanía that will begin the separation, of which 20th century Cuban anthropologist Fernando Ortiz will write in Cuban Counterpoint, between producers of sugar living in the deforested plains and those able to plant and profit, yet still conserve and live on the edge of the abundance and protection of the forest, planting cacao, coffee, and tobacco. Arrate, in his efforts to emphasize this difference, writes of, and I quote, the beautiful variety of flowering trees in the countryside, of fragrant herbs and plants, of the abundance of singing birds, he names nightingales, mockingbirds, mannequins, bellbirds, and cotingas, of game birds like ringdoves, quail, partridges, of the diversity of ducks in rivers and lagoons, and of the birds of flashy and varied feathers, as he called them, such as the flamenco, tanagers, parrots, and parakeets. We know that one of them was already on the verge of extinction. He establishes a clear distinction between these lands of natural abundance and what he calls tierras de labor, literally lands of labor or plantations that require labor force, that produce, besides tobacco and sweet cane, which are the most useful crops, a profusion of manioc, sweet potatoes, ginger, corn, rice, cocoa, and coffee. In his narrative, Arrate implies the existence of three distinct groups in Cuban society, and this is 1666. But by then, he's identifying three distinct groups, all of them, each one of them with a different relationship to the environment. One, the Spaniards, who had brought irreversible changes to the landscapes in the form of new crops and animals. He records every new species they have brought in and their impact on the local environment. And I quote one of his lines. He says, before the Spaniards populated the island, there were no more quadrupeds and certain utillas and certain types of mute dogs, which are now extinct. So the other group he identifies is the isleños, or islanders, his name for the indigenous, whom he sees as belonging to the landscape in a specifically authentic way, as they live off the bounty of the forest and seas. And then a third group is those like him, native-born, or not indigenous, inextricably connected to a new definition of the landscape, seeking to profit from that landscape, but without, unlike the Spaniards, without altering it inexorably. So at the dawn of the 18th century, Pere Labba, in his extensive report of his visit to the Caribbean, written at a time of fast plantation development in Martinique and Guadeloupe, writes of his concerns with the loss of biodiversity. In Guadeloupe, he had encountered the diablotin. He was totally fascinated with this diablotin. I couldn't get your picture because there doesn't seem to be any left. There were never any photos of the diablotin, but drawings of the diablotin seem to be extinct. So in Guadeloupe, he had encountered the diablotin, an ungainly bird the size of a pullet that lived in a hole in the mountains like rabbits. It describes their flesh as dark, with a rather fishy flavor, but good and nourishing. Let me quote this paragraph. He writes, these birds are a veritable manna sent by God every year for the settlers and Negroes who live on little else during the season. It is only the difficulty of getting them which preserves the species. And these birds would be killed out completely in a few years owing to the bad custom of the French, were it not for the fact that they choose the most inaccessible places for their homes. So here you have Pere Labba already calculating the potential lifespan of species, and this is not the only one.